just for my sword. Aegilus said,
I hoped you would leave it, don't you remember? I tried to persuade you to leave, to flee in disguise. I would have given the clothes to you and as much money as I could.
Severian, don't you understand? It was worth 10 times more than our shop, and the shop was all we had.
You've done this before. You must have. Everything went too smoothly. A legal murder with no body to wait for Gile.
You're going to kill Aegilus, aren't you?
That must be why you're here. But you didn't know it was us until you opened the door. What have we done that you're not going to do? Less stridently, her brother's voice followed Aegeus.
It was a fair combat. We were equally armed, and you agreed to the conditions. Will you give me such a fight tomorrow?
You knew that when evening came, the warmth of my hands would stimulate the Avern, and that it would strike at my face. You wore gloves, and you only had to wait. In reality, you didn't even have to do that, because you had thrown the leaves often before. Aegilus smiled.
So the business of the gauntlets was a side issue after all.
He spread his hands.
I won. But in reality, you won by some concealed art neither my sister nor I understand. I have been wronged by you 3 times now. And the old law said that a man 3 times wronged might claim any boon of his oppressor. I grant that the old law is no longer in force. But my darling tells me you have an attachment to times past, when your guild was great and your fortress the center of the Commonwealth. I claim the boon. Set me free.
Aegir rose, brushing the straw from her knees and rounded thighs. As though she realized only now that she was naked, she picked up the blue-green brocade gown I remembered so well and clasped it to her. I said, How have I wronged you, Aegilus? It seems to me that you have wronged me, or tried to.
First by entrapment. You carried an heirloom worth a villa about the city without knowing what it was you had. As owner, it was your duty to know, and your ignorance threatens to cost me my life tomorrow unless you free me tonight. Secondly, by refusing to entertain any offer to buy. In our commercial society, one may set one's price as high as one wishes, but to refuse to sell at any price is treason. Aegir and I wore the gaudy armor of a barbarian. You wore his heart. Thirdly, by the sleight with which you won our combat. Unlike you, I found myself contesting powers greater than I could comprehend. I lost my nerve, as any man would, and here I am. I call on you to free me.
Laughter came unwished for, carrying with it the taste of gall.
You're asking me to do for you, whom I have every reason to despise, what I wouldn't do for Thecla, whom I loved almost more than my own life? No. I'm a fool, and if I was not one before, surely your darling sister has made one of me. But not such a fool as that.
Aegir dropped her gown and threw herself toward me with such violence that I thought for an instant she was attacking me. Instead, she covered my mouth with kisses, and seizing my hands, put one on her breast and the other upon her velvet hip. There were bits of rotten straw there still, and on her back, to which I shifted both hands a moment later.
Severian, I love you. I longed for you when we were together, and tried to give myself to you 10 times. Don't you remember the Garden of Delectation? How much I wanted to take you there? It would have been rapture for us both, but you wouldn't go. For once, be honest.
She spoke as if honesty were an abnormality like mania.
Don't you love me? Take me now. Here. Aegilus will turn his face away, I promise you.
Her fingers had slid between my waistband and my belly, and I was not aware that her other hand had lifted the flap of my saber-tash until I heard the rustle of paper there. I slapped her wrist, perhaps harder than I should, and she flew at me, clawing for my eyes, as Thecla used sometimes to do when she could no longer bear the thoughts of imprisonment and pain. I pushed her away, not into a chair this time, but against the wall. Her head struck the stone, and though it must have been padded by her abundant hair, the sound was as sharp as the tap of a mason's hammer. All the strength seemed to leave her knees. She slid down until she was sitting on the straw. I would never have guessed that Aegir was capable of weeping, but she wept.
Aegilus asked, What did she do?
There was no emotion beyond curiosity in the question. You must have seen her. She tried to reach into my saber-tash. I scooped what coins I possessed out of their compartment, 2 brass aurochs and 7 copper A's. Or perhaps she wanted to steal the letter I have to the Archon of Thrax. I told her about that once, but I don't carry it in here.
She wanted the coins, I'm sure. They've fed me, but she must be dreadfully hungry.
I picked Aja up and thrust her torn gown into her arms, then opened the door and let her out. She was still dazed, but when I gave her an orichalk, she threw it down and spat at it. When I re-entered the cell, Aegidus was sitting cross-legged, his back propped by the wall.
"Don't ask me about Aja," he said. "Everything you suspect is true. Is that enough? I will be dead tomorrow, and she will wed the old man who dotes on her, or someone else. I wanted her to do it sooner. He couldn't have prevented her from seeing me, her brother. Now I will be gone, and she won't have even that to worry about."
"Yes," I said, "you will die tomorrow. That's what I've come to talk to you about. Do you care how you look on the scaffold?" He stared at his hands, slender and rather soft, where they lay in the narrow beam of sunlight that had given his head and Aegis an aureole a few moments before.
"Yes," he said. "She may come. I hope she won't, but yes, I care."
I told him then, as I had been taught, to eat little in the morning so that he would not be ill when the time came, and cautioned him to empty his bladder, which relaxes at the stroke. I drilled him, too, in that false routine we teach to all who must die, so they will think the moment is not quite come when in fact it has come, the false routine that lets them die with something less of fear. I do not know if he believed me, though I hope he did. If ever a lie is justified in the sight of the Pan-Creator, it is that one. When I left him, the orichalk was gone. In its place, and no doubt with its edge, a design had been scratched on the filthy stones. It might have been the snarling face of Jurapari, or perhaps a map, and it was wreathed with the letters I did not know. I rubbed it away with my foot. Chapter 30. Night. There were five of them, three men and two women. They waited outside the door, in a sense, but not near it, grouped a dozen strides away. Waiting, they talked among themselves, two or three talking together, almost shouting, laughing, waving arms, nudging one another. I watched them from the shadows for a time. They could not see me there, or did not, wrapped as I was in my Phlegian cloak, and I was able to pretend I did not know what they were. They might have been at a party, all a little drunk. They came eagerly, yet hesitantly, afraid of being repulsed and determined to make the advance. One man was taller than I, surely the illegitimate son of some exultant, 50 or more, and nearly as fat as the host at the Inn of Lost Loves. A thin woman of 20 or so walked beside him, almost pressing against him. She had the hungriest eyes I have ever seen. When the fat man stepped in front of me, blocking my way with his bulk, she nearly, yet not quite, embraced me, coming so close it seemed almost magical that we did not touch. Her long-fingered hands moving at the opening of my cloak with a desire to stroke my chest, but never quite doing so, so that I felt I was about to fall prey to some blood-drinking ghost, a succubus or lamia. The others crowded around me, hemming me against the building.
"It's tomorrow, isn't it? How does it feel?"
"What's your real name?" "He's a bad one, isn't he? A monster."
None of them waited for answers to their questions, or, so far as I could see, expected or wanted any. They sought propinquity, and the experience of having spoken to me.
"Will you break him first?"
"For the beer brandy."
"Have you ever killed a woman?"
"Yes," I said. "Yes, I did once."
One of the men, short and slight, with a high, bumpy forehead of an intellectual, was putting an assimi into my hand.
"I know you fellows don't get much, and I hear he's a pauper. Can't tip."
A woman, gray hair straggling over her face, tried to make me take a lace-trimmed handkerchief.
"Get blood on it, as much as you want, or even only a little. I'll pay you afterward."
All of them stirred me to pity, even as they revolted me. But one man, most of all. He was even smaller than the one who had given me the money, grayer than the gray-haired woman, and there was a madness in his dull eyes, a shadow of some half-suppressed concern that had worn itself out in the prison of his mind until all its eagerness was gone and only its energy remained. He seemed to be waiting until the other four had finished speaking, and since that time clearly would never come, I quieted them with a gesture and asked him what he wanted.
"Master, when I was on the Quasar, I had a paracoet, a doll, you see, a jennikin, so beautiful with her great pupils as dark as whales, her irises purple like asters, pansies blooming in summer. Master, whole beds of them, I thought, have been gathered to make those eyes that flesh that always felt sun-warmed. Where is she now?
My own
Scopananya, my puppet. Let hooks be buried in the hands that took her. Crush them, master, beneath stones. Where has she gone from the lemon wood box I made for her? Where she never slept at all, for she lay with me all night, not in the box, the lemon wood box where she waited all day. Watch and watch, master, smiling when I laid her in so she might smile when I drew her out. How soft her hands were, her little hands, like doves. She might have flown with them about the cabin had she not chosen instead to lie with me. Wind their guts about your windlass. Stuff their eyes into their mouths. Unman them. Shave them clean below so their doxies may not know them. Their lemons may rebuke them. Leave them to the brazen laughter of the brazen mouths of strumpets. Work your will upon those guilty. Where was their mercy on the innocent? When did they tremble when weep? What kind of men could do as they have done? Thieves, false friends, betrayers, bad shipmates, no shipmates, murderers and kidnappers. Without you, where are their nightmares? Where are their restitutions so long promised? Where are their chains, fetters, manacles, and kangs? Where are their abominations that shall leave them blind? Where are the defenestrations that shall break their bones? Where is the estrapade that shall grind their joints? Where is she, the beloved whom I lost?
Dorcas had found a daisy for her hair, but as we walked about outside the walls, I wrapped in my cloak so that to anyone more than a few paces off it must have seemed that she walked alone. It folded its petals in sleep, and she plucked instead one of those white trumpet-shaped blossoms that are called moonflowers because they appear green in the moon's green light. Neither of us had much to say other than that we would be utterly alone save for the other. Our hands spoke of that, clasping each other tightly. Victuallers came and went, for the soldiers were making ready to depart. To north and east the wall hemmed us round, making the wall that enclosed the barracks and administrative buildings seem no more than children's work, a wall of sand that might be trodden down by accident. To south and west extended the sanguinary field. We heard the trumpet blown there, and the cries of the new monomachists who sought their foes. Both of us, I think, for a time, dreaded that the other would suggest we walk there and watch the combats. Neither did. When the last curfew had come drifting down from the wall, we returned, with a borrowed candle, to our windowless and fireless room. There was no bolt for the door, but we put the table against it and stood the candlestick on that. I had told Dorcas she was free to go, and that forever afterward it would be said of her that she was a torturer's woman who gave herself under the scaffold for money spotted with blood. She had said,
"That money has clothed and fed me."
Now she drew off the brown mantle, which hung to her heels, and beyond, when she was not careful of it, so the hem dragged in the dust, and smoothed the raw yellow-brown linen of her simar. I asked if she were frightened.
"Yes,"
she said, then quickly,
"Oh, not of you."
"Of what, then?" I was taking off my clothes. If she had asked me, I would not have touched her throughout the night. But I wanted her to ask. Indeed, I wanted her to beg, and the pleasure I would have had in abstinence would then have been at least as great, as I thought, as I would have had in possession, with the additional pleasure of knowing that on the next night she would feel the more obliged because I had spared her.
"Of myself, of what thoughts may return to me when I lie again with a man?"
"Again? Do you remember a time before?" Dorcas shook her head.
"But I am certain I am no virgin. I have desired you often, yesterday and today. For whom did you believe I washed myself? Last night I held your hand while you slept, and I dreamed we sated ourselves and lay in each other's arms. But I know satiety as well as desire, so I have known one man at least. Do you wish me to remove this before I blow out the candle?"
She was slender, high-breasted, and narrow-hipped, strangely childlike to me, though fully a woman. "You seem so small," I said, and held her to me.
"And you are so big."
I knew then that however much I tried not to, I would hurt her, that night and afterward. I knew, too, that I was incapable of sparing her. A moment before, I would have refrained if she had asked. Now I could not, and just as I would have thrust forward, though it had plunged my body on a spike, I would follow her later and try to cleave her to me. But it was not my body that was impaled, but hers. We had been standing while I ran my hands over her and kissed her breasts that were like round fruits sliced in two. Now I lifted her, and together we fell on one of the beds. She cried out, half in delight, half in pain, and pushed me away before she clutched at me.
"I'm glad," she said. "I'm so glad,"
and bit me on the shoulder. Her body bent backward like a bow. Later, we pushed the beds together so we could lie side by side. Everything was slower the second time. She would not agree to a third.
"You'll need your strength tomorrow," she said.
"Then you don't care."
"If we could have our way, no man would have to go roving or draw blood. But women do not make the world. All of you are torturers, one way or another."
It rained that night so hard we could hear it drumming on the tiles over our heads, a cleansing, crashing, unending downpour of water. I dozed and dreamed that the world had been turned upside down. Gile was overhead now, decanting all its flood of fish and filth and flowers over us. I saw the great face I had seen under the water when I had nearly drowned, a portent of coral and white seen in the sky, smiling with needle teeth. Thrax is called the city of windowless rooms. This windowless room of ours, I thought, is a preparation for Thrax. Thrax will be like this. Or perhaps Dorcas and I are already there. It was not so far north as I thought. So far north as I was led to believe. Dorcas got up to go out, and I went with her, knowing it would not be safe for her to go alone at night in a place where there were so many soldiers. The corridor outside our room ran along an outer wall, pierced with embrasures. Water splashed through each in a fine spray. I wanted to keep Terminus Est in her sheath, but so large a sword is slow to draw. When we were back in our room again, with the table against the door, I took out the whetstone and sharpened the man's side of the blade, honing its edge until the endmost third, the part I would use, would divide a thread tossed into the air. Then I wiped and oiled the whole blade and stood the sword against the wall near my head. Tomorrow would be my first appearance on the scaffold, unless the Chiliarch decided at the last moment to exercise clemency.